Welcome to AMA Edgewise. I'm Dave Summers. AMA Edgewise is brought to you by the American Management Association. Chris Conde is SunGard's president, chief executive officer, and he's a member of the board of directors. He was elected chief executive officer in 2002 and has been a board member since 1999. Mr. Conde served as chief operating officer between 1999 and 2002 and previously headed SunGard's trading systems division, which he started in 1990. Prior to joining SunGard, Mr. Conde co-founded Devon Systems International, which was acquired by SunGard in 1987. At the time, Devon focused on providing systems for the interest rate and currency derivatives markets. Born in Santiago, Chile, Mr. Conde is a U.S. citizen and holds a B.S. in astronomy and physics from Yale University. Chris, welcome to Edgewise.
Thanks for having me.
To begin with, tell us a little bit about SunGard.
SunGard is a large software and processing company, and we have four businesses. First, we help financial institutions trade and account for trades and positions and funds, dealing mostly with the wholesale side of finance. We also have a business serving colleges and universities, and we provide all the administrative systems that underlie the workings of a college or university. We also help institutions in the public sector, whether it's police forces or fire departments, with their public safety job requirements. Finally, we also have a large business in availability services, providing continuity and backup facilities for companies across all types of industries.
So in the year 2002, you became CEO. At that point, did you have any specific goals in mind for the company going into the future?
Yes. The company had been run as a series of very, very autonomous businesses. That was the right strategy at a time when there was a lot of growth. When you have a lot of underlying growth, it's okay to have lots of oars in the water. But we saw tech spending slowing down. We saw large customers wanting to focus more of their spending with fewer vendors. So it made sense to have a more integrated strategy for running the company. And we moved in that direction with some successes and some failures.
Most of your growth, I believe, has been acquisition-based.
Over the very long haul, about half the revenue growth has been acquired growth and half of it internal growth.
Now, in 2005, you took the company private. Why did you make that decision?
We were approached by Silver Lake, who then organized a consortium to take the company private. And it was a very credible offer for the shares. So we, of course, had to listen. But it didn't mean that we necessarily would be all for it. But looking at their track record and ability to invest over the very long term, we saw an opportunity to make the right kinds of investments. It would take time for those investments to grow. And we saw an opportunity to do things that would have been very difficult to do as a public company. That's why we took the company private. We still have to pay attention on the short term. It's just that the balance of attention shifts from the short term to the long term.
Of course, you're allowed to do that in a private company and also make decisions a lot faster than you might in a public company.
I think the decision making is just about as fast in a public company. The difference is that you don't have to concern yourself with the very short-term volatility your decisions might cause. If the earnings are up, then they're down. Net-net, they're on plan. But the public markets can tolerate a lot less volatility than private investors.
How did it benefit you during the recession? It seems you were already aware of some of the warning signs of a downturn.
Yes. In the early summer, before Lehman fell and before all those things happened, we were seeing lots of very worrying signs. I got all of the senior managers in one room. Everybody flew in. And I posed a very simple question to them. When is the last time you saw these many red flags and there was a happy ending? And everybody said, never. So we came up with two contingency cases. One we call the yellow case, the other one we call the red case. And we said, let's assume that revenues are in the yellow case and that we need to take expenses down to the red case. And that's what we decided. As it turns out, after the financial crisis was much bigger than what any of us thought, we ended up running the company on red revenues and expenses on a black case, which didn't exist as of that summer. But taking early action on expenses meant that A, we could get them all done with, and B, and this was really the important thing, we could be out there competing at a time when our competitors were focused on making cuts internally. So we were largely unopposed in many system decisions. Also, by cutting expenses early, we were able to then not have to do large expense cuts late. Anybody that cut late had to cut even more in order to catch up.
Chris, one of the things that you've talked about a great deal in interviews is a program that you set up at SunGard called Why Buy. Can you talk a little bit about that?
One of our young developers had an idea, said, we're trying to cut expenses. We have so many offices around the world, and this office might have just upgraded their network router or whatever, and they have a router sitting on the side. They don't really know what to do with it, but some other office might need it. So this developer set up a website called Why Buy, which I thought was a very clever name, where people can post equipment that is unneeded, and then that equipment can be bought by other SunGard entities, and then people get credit towards their budget for whatever it is they got for the piece of equipment. It facilitates the reuse of equipment, and I think it's an ingenious use of technology. This very simple browser application, kind of like a Craigslist, but within the company, that transformed the way we buy things internally, and it saved a lot of money.
Now, when the recession hit, did you have to reduce the size of your workforce?
We did do layoffs. Going into the recession, we had around 20,500 people. We took that down to 19,000. We're back up to full employment now. But I think we bounced back partly because we made those cuts early. So we were focused on being out there, being competitive at a time when others weren't.
So the fact that you had those early warning systems prevented deeper cuts.
Absolutely. Too many people look at financial metrics, which are rearward looking. It's like driving, looking at the mirror. So I think it's important for any business to develop metrics that give you warning signals about what's happening ahead, and then to simplify those signals, because the purpose of the signal and of the metric is not to run the company for you, but rather to throw off red flags as to when it is you should really look at something and really pay attention. And then there's no alternative but to roll up your sleeves and really dig in. There's no metric, no report that will tell you what to do. But those early warning signals can be very different than what a typical financial report might look like.
I would think that when you have to make those types of decisions, and the decisions aren't necessarily ones you want to make, you have to move quickly. Speed is important.
Yes, there's some decisions that are very difficult decisions, and there are other decisions that are just really unpleasant. And laying off people is unpleasant, because in that kind of cut, you're not talking about poor performers. You're talking about people that have never done anything wrong. It's just that there isn't enough work for them. That is a really unpleasant decision. And the best way to deal with an unpleasant decision is to get it over with as quickly as possible. Time is not on your side.
Absolutely. But now we're coming out of the recession. And I saw one of the reports that you made to the public. You talk about the importance of training your salespeople to be more than salespeople. Do you want to expand on that a little bit?
I think the days of a customer calling saying, I want XYZ, could you please sell it to me? And then the salesperson responding, they're long gone. It's very much now a solution sale where you have to really go in and find out the real needs of the customer and then shape your offering around those needs and show how you can quickly deliver value. Customer's actually not interested in your product. Customer is interested in solving a business problem. So you have to show how you're going to solve a business problem. And then you also have to take risk. So that whole sales process is far more complex than what it used to be. So we run a sales academy, and we have courses on solution selling and what works, what doesn't. We just share experiences, good and bad, because in business, we don't talk enough about our failures. You can learn so much more from failures and successes. It's very hard to figure out what to copy to make the success happen again. But when you see a failure and you talk about publicly and openly and fully, then people say, oh yeah, definitely, I wouldn't want to do that.
So that way your salespeople are more familiar with the best approaches SunGard has learned.
Yes, absolutely.
Okay, looking now to a more positive future, what do you see as the key responsibilities for yourself as CEO moving SunGard forward?
The role of the CEO has changed so much. In the old days, when information was hard to get a hold of, the CEO had better information than anybody else. Therefore, a lot of decisions had to be made by the CEO. But now, every bit of information is available to everybody equally. So the CEO is not somebody who can make better decisions because they have more information. the role of the CEO now is really the other way around, to empower the greatest number of people within the organization to be able to make decisions and reserve to the CEO just the handful of decisions that can only be made by the CEO. For instance, taking the company private. I could not have delegated that one, but pretty much anything else you can delegate, and you should.
Exactly. I think you're absolutely right. But how can leaders do that?
Decisions are best made when they're made at the lowest possible level of an organization. When something comes to my desk, I read it carefully because I figure somebody's sending it to me, I should read it. But then the question I ask myself is, why is this coming to me in the first place? Is it because I know something that nobody else does, in which case you should figure out a way to teach it to them? Or is it because I have not delegated enough power in the organization? I've learned that you are so far better off delegating the maximum number of things, because then you can truly hold people accountable and you can keep better people.
So Chris, let's talk a little bit about your leadership style. How would you describe it?
What I try to do is come up with a very simple set of goals that can last a very long time and then hold people accountable towards those goals. Some of those goals could be financial, some of them could be non-financial. It takes a long time to define what those goals should be. For one organization, improving customer relationships might be the number one goal. For another one, it's successful product rollout. For somebody else, it might be international expansion. You just need to focus on what is really more important than anything else. And then you have to be absolutely relentless and hold people accountable to that.
Now, I have a question for you. We're seeing an emphasis on the leadership role in terms of vision. But do you see a management side to the role of CEO?
I myself think that visions are not worth much and can't be executed on. So the role of a leader is to simplify the vision, and it typically is somebody else's vision for that matter, simplify it to the point where your organization can deliver on it in a very, very unique way and with a high degree of success. That is something that is equally about management than about leadership. Why is it that we're going towards this goal? Why is it important? And why is it that we can do it? Why is it that it's going to be fun? And why is it that we will succeed? You have to then stick to that message for a long time. You know, it takes a long time for organizations to understand what the leader is actually saying. So if the leader changes his or her mind about what's the number one goal faster than the speed at which the organization can take up that message, then it's kind of pointless.
So it's not only to help move the company, but also make it happen.
Yes, absolutely. And without making it happen, it's not worth the paper it's written on. In the end, it all boils down to execution.
And I'm sure you agree, an awful lot of companies suffer from strategy execution problems.
Yes, a disconnect. The strategy might be fine, no execution, or poor creative execution, but they're completely missing the boat.
And do you have any secrets you could share with us to make sure that execution occurs?
You have to be tolerant of people taking risks and getting it wrong when it comes to a particular product or a particular type of offering. But when it comes to execution, you can't tolerate too many mistakes. Those can be fatal. You simply have to have a culture where executing well is considered not only good, but also cool. I think companies don't put enough emphasis on what is actually considered to be cool inside the company. Is it to develop a brand new application that just looks great but isn't used? Or is it to bring a client live onto the application and deliver value to the customer and solve their problem? In any company, something is considered more cool than anything else. And you as a leader, you need to latch on to that, because when you're talking about a large organization with tens of thousands of people and many layers between you and the front line, you need to understand what is considered cool within the organization, because then you can use that to motivate better behavior.
And that's the way you've developed a culture for your people, by emphasizing what's cool?
I never talk about it in terms of what is cool, but you are constantly talking about it. When you're doing some idle chatter, what do you talk about? Do you talk about sports, or do you talk about some customer going live and solving an incredible problem or whatever? And then pretty soon people get the idea that customers achieving their goals is a very good thing, and that people get recognition for that. And I'm not talking necessarily about monetary recognition, but non-monetary recognition. People don't make enough use of peer recognition, which is one of the most powerful drivers within all of us.
You've said that the flatter an organization, the better. And I believe you actually changed your organization from a top-down to a more collaborative approach.
Yes. The change we did had a very clear beginning. The company was run as a series of very disparate silos and business units, many, many of them. And we needed to integrate them and bring them closer together. Step one was to have a physical integration and have larger businesses solving problems. But to go beyond that couldn't be done just by smashing all these businesses together. It had to be done by getting people to collaborate across businesses. How do you get people to collaborate if they don't have a shared boss? If they work for different people, they have different incentives. How do you get people to collaborate that I've never actually met or even emailed each other? How do you get them to share their work? How do you get them to communicate? What is it they're working on? Maybe somebody else has exactly that same problem and could use it. We tried different approaches. One of the ones we settled on draws a lot from the open source movement and technology, which is a way for people to post bits of application code, things they're working on, and then they brag about it. Then somebody else could improve it. They come up with different versions. Then you get the community as a whole voting on which version is better. And pretty soon, the developers start being recognized by their name, and people start being recognized for their work. So somebody that worked in a small office, their boss wasn't about to retire, maybe they were considering looking for another job, and now they're being recognized on a global basis by people they never met. And the power of that recognition is enormous.
Did you have people who didn't really believe that there was a change and it was a top-down approach? How did you convince those people that you were indeed a collaborative executive?
Collaboration is a very humbling experience for a CEO because you are not going to be out there saying, we should be doing this, we should be doing that, and getting all the positive energy and accolades. But in the end, you simply have to realize that those things don't necessarily add value. And focusing on implementing systems where employees can collaborate, where people can build on each other's work and can share the good experiences and the bad, can create far more lasting value, where it's all of your employees, the lower, the better, that have information that's needed to make decisions.
Chris, could you go deeper on that for us?
I think a lot of people talk about collaboration as if it was something simple, where in fact, it's one of the most difficult things to achieve. How do you get people who don't work for the same person, who have never met, have never spoken, to actually work together on something, be able to help each other and reuse each other's work in a way that gets the product done faster? That's an extremely difficult task. Because the crux of it is not about the technology, not about knowing what each other's working on. The crux of it is the reward system. I'm not talking about monetary rewards, but what is it people think will be talked about? So if you want people to collaborate, you need to then say, oh, so-and-so built this using bits of code that he or she gathered from five other places. Then the person that assembled that code and reused code and collaborated with others is seen as more cool than somebody having done 100% of the work completely on their own. So you have to work on the reward systems and you have to work on the communication systems to make sure that people actually know what they're all working on, can talk about what's on their mind and give opinions. And pretty soon, once you have these collaboration systems, people start seeing that, well, so-and-so from this office in Frankfurt, Germany is consistently insightful. So I'm going to follow them. And people get a following. That is an incredible positive rush to be followed by people you never met just because they think your ideas are insightful. I think companies should do more of that.
Okay, so how do you maintain an ongoing communication with your workforce?
Regular calls with all employees. Of course, there's far too many people to just get on a conference call and answer questions with everybody else on. But the way I do it is to then take questions by email. And whichever is the last question that popped up, that's the one I read and I answer it to the best of my knowledge. The questions come in on all sorts of topics. The first time I did this, I'll never forget, the second question that came up was, Chris, when are you going to extend benefits to same-sex couples? I answered the question, and I've always thought I was so lucky I got that question, because after somebody asked that question, everybody felt they could ask anything.
So you developed a feeling of trust among your workforce.
You should always assume the people that work for you are far smarter than you think they are, because then you will not be blindsided. That also means if a question comes up, to not try to dumb down the answer, just give the answer the way it is, as if you were talking to a close colleague, for better or for worse. Sometimes it doesn't matter what the answer is. What matters is knowing that the leader is being truthful, honest, high degree of integrity, and the leader will tell you exactly what's in his or her head.
And you maintain that credibility over time.
It's something that you build, and then in times of great trouble, it's a strength you can draw from.
So Chris, would you say collaboration is an essential part of your leadership style?
Collaboration has a lot to do with it. Also, what really makes a difference in the end is whether or not you're really holding people accountable for the very key goals that you agreed to, as opposed to holding them accountable to do whatever it was that you told them to do the day before. I go through great amounts of trouble whenever I voice an opinion to tell people, this is just my opinion. You're free to do whatever you think should be done, and you're free to disregard my opinion, but you'll still get the benefit of knowing what my opinion is. Then they are under no doubt that they're going to be held accountable for fulfilling the goal. And I won't care whether or not they ignored all of my suggestions or they actually took them. It's very easy for people to get confused on that. And sometimes leaders are saying one thing, but they really mean another. They're saying, I'm going to hold you accountable, but actually, what about these three things that I said yesterday? Have you done any of them? And that kind of stuff is bad. You simply have to hold your tongue and refuse to micromanage.
Chris, before we wrap up, is there anything else you'd like to leave our listeners with?
Yes. I try to see a customer every day. Partly it's because I can add value, but the bigger reason is it grounds me in terms of what's going on both with our customers and with our employees. So let's say that I'm taking the subway or taking a taxi to go see a customer. The rep or the account manager is thinking about the meeting. They're not really preparing for the impromptu meeting they're going to have with me in the taxi or in the subway. And I ask them all sorts of questions. What is it that we're trying to do here? What's the customer interested? But then I go into, how long have you been here? What else would you do if you couldn't do SunGard? I find out more about them. What are their top challenges at work? And all this stuff comes out. It's not necessarily stuff that's actionable. It just goes into my head, and then I start looking for patterns. So I learn a lot from the customers because of my title. They will tell me things they will not tell the account manager. And the trip to and from the customer is extremely valuable, which is also why I go with only one person. If you go with many people from your team, then nobody's going to say anything.
I'd like to thank our guest on today's program, Chris Conde of SunGard. Chris, thanks a lot for being here.
Thank you very much.
Have you attended an AMA webcast? These free one-hour programs deliver practical insight into the latest business issues as well as leadership and management challenges. For a complete schedule of upcoming webcasts, visit the events calendar at amanet.org/events. Thanks for taking us along. I'm Dave Summers, and you've been listening to AMA's Edgewise.